All right. Okay, guys, it's hey, I apologize for this. You know, we got back from spring break and the video projector, the big good one, went out, and we have these two little ones that like to look like that. And you can't, kind of depends on where you're standing, doesn't it? And I can turn one of them off, but I can't make it go away, so it's a blue screen. So I'll just put them both up, and you can look at one with, maybe you can get stereoscopic view or something, I don't know. But anyway, it's been a few weeks since I've been up here, at least. We had that nice spring break, and then we get back from that. We had a couple of guests that kind of transitioned us in. But now I'm back, and we're here, you're back, and we're going to put the big push, the big speedy end to this thing, this semester and this course, all right? For better or for worse, we're going to blast through to the end here. It's April 1st, April Fool's Day, and so that means we're done in this month. And what, looking ahead, we have a very few number of lectures to go. Today I'm going to talk about human expansion. We've got a real good water pollution film that I also have that I'll be commenting on in class. That's real good. And then we're going to talk about air pollution. So basically we've got water pollution, air pollution. Then the big gorilla in the room is this whole global carbon thing. And we're going to spend 2 days and try to get all the way to the bottom of that, through some of the weeds on that, so that you have a clear and I hope rational understanding of exactly what's coming down. And then we do end up with wastewater. I think everybody ought to know when they flush what happens. Okay, and so that's going to be the course. I will make sure to get at least 3, maybe 4 extra credit squeezed in there over those, what is it, just 5 lectures to go. And then you will notice that we don't have any lectures in the last week of class. I offer on the Tuesday of the last week an option for you to take the third test early. If you've missed a test, I urge you to take this option because you'll be making up a test at May 1st, okay, during final exam period. So I urge you to take that early option. If you've already taken 2 of your tests on time, it's entirely up to you. About half the students elect not to take it the last week and want to put it off because they're busy the last week. There's a reason I can't require a test in the last week. I understand that. That's why it's optional. But the other half, heck, they say, you know, I've already taken 2 of my tests. I can be done with this class on April 22nd if I take that third test. Okay? So that's where it stands, and you all make the decision on that. But I do urge you to come to class. We're going to be moving fast. All right, so that's kind of what you need to know. And now let's get talking. This lecture today, it's going to be a beautiful day outside, isn't it? A beautiful spring day. We're about ready for it, man. I am. I know you are too. However, this whole last section, which is entitled, after all, The Abuse of Natural Resources, tends to be not the happiest section for me to talk about. There is some good news in there. We do have some fun in there. But there's also pretty serious shit coming down. And you are the young people They're going to be living it out. Not me, all right? And so, what? Oh, that's a blank screen because that's what I have. And so, today is, I'm going to throw a lot out at you. I'm going to kind of set up the rest of the other four lectures that are going to be about specific abuse problems. But I'm going to kind of set up the general situation. I think a lot of you kind of know where we are. You've seen some of this stuff before. I'm going to be throwing population and energy data at you and all kinds of stuff. And what I want to do is for you to take away a general impression and kind of get a... It gets a little serious. And what I entitled this is... Human expansion. That's the lecture. And what we're talking about is that for most of humans' time on Earth, we've just kind of been these other animals running around trying to survive. But since the medical, the scientific, and most importantly, the industrial revolutions occurred, beginning about 1700 or a little earlier, and then continuing apace for about 200 years, 300 years into the present day, we have come to expand to fill the globe. Humans have. This is a new phenomenon. We didn't always fill the globe until very recently. We've been modern humans have been on Earth for 500,000 years, 500,000 years or so. But it's only in the last couple of hundred that we've filled the globe and continue to fill it full. I showed you this picture like the first day, I think, and we're coming back to it. This is a picture I said, you've grown up with it. It's just kind of always been there. Yeah, it's a cool picture, I guess. But I told you, try to think of me, who had no idea such a picture existed until I was almost your age. And then it was sent back from the Apollo circling the moon. And it was breathtaking. And it showed us how alive Earth was, doesn't it? It also shows you kind of how alone and how desolate, looking at the lunar surface below and the black void of space, that little bit of Shangri-La, or our little spaceship Earth, is out there. And that kind of also, we can see the vulnerability there. And then when we look, I also on the first day, we had some pictures from circling spacecraft. This is looking down on the North Pole. You can see here in the lower part, California over here, New England over here, southern Canada, and then of course not much up to the north, and then of course you see Europe, Asia, Japan, glowing like a red hot poker over there in the Pacific Ocean. There's a composite, obviously, this you don't have night everywhere on Earth, it's a composite, but of the lights on Earth shining out. This shows you to the extent to which we fill the globe. And this, you know, how do we expand? Human expansion, right. So how is it we expand? Well, this is a figure you've seen again. It's kind of like that Earth thing. You can't remember when you didn't see it. This depiction of the expanding human population. You know, for much of historical time, our human population was less than 1 billion people on Earth, right? And really, there's a lot of argument can be stated. You know, there's a lot of talk about sustainability. You know, what can we sustain? What kind of lifestyle can we have year after year, not for 10 years or 100 years, but 10,000 years? Like the Indians of the Pacific Northwest. You know, is what we're doing now sustainable for 100,000 years? I don't think many people would say yes. Probably, looking at population alone, once you get over about a billion, you're kind of out of the natural carrying capacity of the earth for human beings, right? The earth handled a billion. You can kind of be on the sun budget and support a billion humans worldwide. But once we broke that, you can't even see that legend on the left there. Once we had first, like I say, the discovered bacteria, is all that Louis Pasteur's fault, wasn't it? He discovered that diseases are catchable and how a little bit of hygiene could go a long way in keeping vast numbers of people from dying of contaminated. All right. Population in billions. There in 1804, we were still at what I say was the kind of long-term sustainable Earth population without any kind of technology. You don't need anything fancy. You can just farm, have animals and sailing ships and crap like that and sustain a billion people. However, by the World War I, we had surpassed a second billion, depending on the revolution in health that had taken hold, and in fact the revolution in industry that created a lot of material things, and then of course the population continues to increase. Now, I'm leery of projections. We don't know what the future holds. I wouldn't worry too much about this. The fact of the matter is we are about 7 billion people as it is, and that's a lot of damn people. That's what we see filling up the globe. But is that really? We can't really see. When we looked at the lights, we saw the evidence of industry and energy, not really of individual people. If you were to go back to those pictures of the globe, and well, you can kind of see it on this northern hemisphere. The southern hemisphere would be a more vivid picture. But let's see. Here in Asia, well, you can't really. But if you got a good southern hemisphere picture, you would see that there are, take the continent of Africa. There's a lot of people in Africa. It's not just a whole hell of a lot of lights. It's not that visible from space. So here we begin to see that the expansion is taken two ways. Two ways we can span. One is in sheer numbers, yes. And in sheer numbers, it's not our fault, is it? If you think very narrowly about us being U.S., we have only 1/20 of the people's of the people of the world live in the United States. But when you think of the other side, the other way we have expanded, the energy and consumption way, then of course there's that distribution of population now. That's still the first part. And we see USA and the leaf green up there, relatively small slice even compared to red Europe. And then you see in the blues over here on the right side of the pie, you see the Asian populations, which are huge. Africa being purple there is substantial itself. And then let's see, but let's look at wealth. Let's look at average wealth per adult, and this is fairly recent data, 2010, 2011, and you can see now what you're supposed to get away from this is not, hell, where's my quarter million? No, that's, where is your quarter million? Well, somebody else in the United States has it. if you don't. So anyway, this is an average apportioned out as if you had a quarter million. That's how much you would have if it was all the money in the U.S. was evenly distributed. But the point here is not where's your quarter million. The point is USA, Japan, and then you drop down to those Asian, those more populous numbers, nations, right? And all of a sudden, you're an order of magnitude less in terms of money, and that means in terms of material consumption. Okay? And if you were to put some poor African countries on here below India, they might be $1,000 average for the whole, for one person's average out wealth for the whole nation. And so what this boils down to is that while you can have small populations, as industrialized countries do, if you have high consumption, you have expanded in a very big way just as much or more than a large population that consumes very little. Put another way, let's see what I got here. Nice energy, let's don't go there quite yet. Come on, go back. What happened here? One thing I will add on to this is that we have 1/20th, the U.S., of the world's population. I stated that. But then, we consume 1/6 of the resources. That means we might consume anywhere, whether you're talking about India or you're talking about the poorest sub-Saharan Africa or something. We, the average consumer here in the U.S., is consuming something like 10 to 30 times as the poorest people on earth. And of course, it is, so that is, you have a weight of that many people, right? In terms of, it's just how you view expansion. You got numbers, you got consumption. And we can't forget both. This is probably not big news to you. Let's look at energy. Energy is a good kind of, probably all the wealth could be pretty much equated in energy, material things, certainly. To the extent that we have a giant classroom like this with pipe organs and padded seats, this all ultimately boils down to material resources, which all pretty much in the end can be boiled down to energy. It is, after all, the Industrial Revolution and the expenditure of fossil fuels that made all of this possible. If this were still dependent on donkeys and human labor, we might have an auditorium, but it would be much cruder and ruder, as it would have to be. Now, let's look at energy consumption. We have long been, Japan and Western Europe, and the Soviet Union, not too far behind, have always been in the 20th century and going into the 21st, large, major consumers of the world's energy. What, of course, has happened now, and if this graph looks like it's kind of been chopped off, that is because I did chop off those projections that I'm not sure are correct. But anyway, the reality is we have China expanding vastly and now consuming, as of course many, many, many more people, five times the population of the U.S., but consuming now as much energy. This has just happened in the last year or two. But there's a troubling side of this, of course, for the environment. Because if a single person has an impact on the biosphere, as I think we all agree he must or she must, that impact is multiplied by their consumption, of course. If you don't have a car and all you do is walk everywhere, You're not going to be putting out a lot of carbon dioxide, just a little huffing and puffing CO2. That's not going to be an issue, I don't think. But then if you drive a car, and if you drive that car 20,000 miles, or you take the jet plane every week or every month, then all of a sudden your impact as an individual is more enormous. So your impact on the biosphere goes up with energy consumption. Of course, why China is increasing their energy is not to be bad on the biosphere. It is. But their reason is to become more materially wealthy. You can hardly fault folks who live in the shadow of what we put out on YouTube, the internet, glossy magazines, and seeing how we live and not, they want a piece of the action. And to the extent that the folks in those Asian nations are African or South American, but the Asians moving on it fastest, get that increased material standard of living, expend that energy. See, if China were to expend much energy per person as the U.S., that red line would be off the chart, wouldn't it? It would be beyond the table legend, the figure legend, way on up there someplace. To the extent that they seek material wealth and consume more energy, the effect of the biosphere is multiplied. And of course, that's where we sit right now in 2010. And that is the part that really gives us pause. Now, let's look in at something that's changed. I've changed this lecture. This lecture is one that actually has to be changed every year because this is a dynamic area. And one thing that's changing very rapidly is this energy. We're all familiar with the shale gas revolution in the United States. Okay? And what this graph shows is natural gas production in the U.S. and what is the shale gas, this right here. Okay? And then, of course, it will continue to increase somewhat. We've probably not a whole lot more. We're already producing a shitload more gas than we ever have. The other big point was back here when I was in college, interestingly enough. But anyway, this is the so-called shale gas revolution, where we've learned to release gas. And this technology is now being exported around the world. We're not the only people that have this kind of gas. Now, you know, how does an environmentalist look at the shale gas revolution, you know? And, let's set aside whether fracking causes earthquakes and to what extent it pollutes groundwater. I think those are relative. What I'm talking is the big global scale issues here. And we know, on the one hand, we know that natural gas, if you're going to burn a fossil fuel, can be burnt extremely cleanly for a fossil fuel. In other words, the problem, as you know, and as we'll talk about when we get to the global carbon cycle, the problem with burning fossil fuels and to generate all this energy and wealth is that these fossil fuels put off carbon dioxide. And carbon dioxide is not a passive gas. It has an active role in the biosphere. It's been going on for as long as the Earth has been in existence, way before humans were here, and it will continue now that we're here and producing CO2 in a very active way. So what's the good then, again, am I saying? Is that gas produces the same unit of energy as coal, for example, a you know, the worst case comparison in terms of carbon dioxide pollution, and it only produces, it'll produce a BTU at 60% of the carbon pollution as coal. 60%. So if you can reduce your CO2 production by 40% and not give up any energy, that's what switching to gas does. That's why there has not been a new coal-fired plant created in the U.S. in the last 10 years, and there won't be. And it won't be because environmentalists won't let it. It's going to be because you'd be an idiot to go that direction when you've got this just as cheap, much cleaner alternative. And frankly, I mean, I don't want to step on anybody's toes here, but if you're a friend of coal, you need to get on Facebook and find a new friend, okay? I mean, my grandfather was friends of buggy manufacturers in 1906, okay? He probably felt sorry for them that their business was going to shit, but I mean, this happens. You guys are going to grow up. That's the big thing you've been told ever for the last 5 or 6 years, right? You won't know the next, you know, the what job you end up doing in 30 years. You have no idea. So let's not worry when, by necessity, certain industries fade out. However, there is a concern of mine that the demand for energy is so great. Yes, we're going to export natural gas. That's a no-brainer. It takes a while to get up the infrastructure to do that. But we're also going to, tempted anyway, to export coal. We're not going to burn it here. Hell no. Fuck, touch that shit. But we sell it to India and China, and they've still got, you know, they'll burn it. So what, I mean, what are we getting here? I'm not sure. I think we could use some wisdom there. There's, you know, with this whole fossil fuel thing, we can't burn it all, guys. If we burn all the damn reduced carbon that's in the ground, the earth is toast. I mean, you gotta leave some of it. You gotta pick and choose. And if you're gonna choose some energy, the fossil fuel, this is probably the one to choose. Not coal, not shale, not tar sands oil, for the love of God, right? But natural gas. Now, here's the thing. So this is a great thing, right? This is like a windfall. In a way it is. But what do we do with it? Here's an analogy. Let's say you have this gambler, chronic gambler, has lost all his money. They're about to foreclose on his house. His wife's leaving him. He's completely broke. He's helpless, adrift. And then he goes to the mailbox one day, and some uncle he never heard of has left him $100,000. Whoa! He got bought some time. It's not enough money to live the rest of his life on, hell no. But it could make some mortgage payments. It'd probably get his wife back if he straightened up here a little bit, did the financially right thing to do. So he sits there with a decision. I got a limited windfall, a limited good thing. Will I use it to change the way I live? Or will I go back to the casino and be broke in 24 hours? That's what this is giving us. This is our $100,000 inheritance. This will not last till you're old people. But it is an opportunity to make a transition easier to an alternative way of life. All right. Okay, I'm going to, I want to change gears here a little bit. I'm going to put a graph here. I'm going to make you think. You like to eat, right? We all like to eat. We know where food comes from. comes from farmers. We don't grow it ourselves. We might grow a little bit, but you'd certainly starve very quickly if you ate only what you grew. So we have these big farms using fossil fuels to produce food. We know that fossil fuels, one way or the other, if they don't run, to the extent that the good ones run out, and the bad ones would kill the earth if we continue to use them indefinitely. You got to change. And so, and even the good ones would kill the earth if you use them indefinitely. But here's the problem. Here's a graph. On this axis, it's real easy. It's just time. Let's put 1910 of all times. And then let's put 1940, World War II era, and now. Okay. And let's put one here, unity. And then let's put 5, and then let's put 10. Now, what are the units on the vertical scale? This is where I want, you're going to have to think a little bit here, because I want you to understand this. And it's like when we get to the global carbon, you're going to have to think a little bit about how this is actually working in the atmosphere. But that thinking will be rewarded with an understanding that'll stick with you. What we have here on the vertical axis is calories in. This is energy. There's a lot of ways to measure energy. BTUs, joules, watts. But when we talk about food energy, we usually use calories, which are a unit of heat. They are units of heat some fashion or another. But it's a unit of heat we associate with. That donut is 250 calories, we know. So we'll use calories, but it's energy. So it's calories in divided by calories out. That's what 1, 5, and 10 are. Now, I'm not talking about, let's think a little bit here. I'm not talking about the sun's energy. That is calories too, that goes in, and that goes in, that actually does a photosynthetic trick, hat trick, the wonderful trick that allows life on Earth. But I'm not counting that calories. I'm not counting the sun calories. What I'm counting is the calories that the farmer puts in to growing the crop. The labor, the transportation, tilling the food fields, weeding the fields, harvesting the crops, moving the crop to the consumer. All of this takes energy, doesn't it? In pre-industrial times, all this energy came from the farmer's muscles or the muscles of his livestock, didn't it? Or occasional water wheel or something. But for the most part, wind turbine thing, little pump the water up. But for the most part, it was either you or your ox or your donkey or your mule or your wife or your kids that were putting this energy in to grow the crop. And then the crop has food energy. We're getting a free ride. The sun's energy, we're not counting. But you are going to have to put energy in and get energy out. Now, in pre-industrial times, you could not be over one, could you? Oh, you could be over one for maybe a year if you had some grain reserves. Because think about it. If you're over one, that means you're putting more calories into that crop than you're getting out. And if the crop, the calories you're getting out are feeding you and feeding your donkey, guess what? You just starved to death and ate your donkey on the way. That's famine. Going over one in a pre-industrial society is famine. All of agriculture for thousands of years, all of human agriculture had to stay under one. That was sustainable. Beyond one was not sustainable. You can't put more energy in than you get energy out and live to tell about it, unless what? Unless you drilled an oil well. And they did. In the late 1800s. And by 1900, they had the first tractors. Ag mechanization came to the farm in the early 20th century. In 1910 is the first year that U.S. agriculture exceeded one calorie in per one calorie out, and nobody starved, because that extra calories in came from petroleum put into gas in the tractor. So we'd always been under one, and then in 1910 we went up. By 1940 we were up to five. We're up to an average of 10 calories. When you see the donut has 250 calories that you're going to consume, no, that's not, that means that 2,500 calories of fossil fuels went into that donut, more or less, to get 250 out. Now, given we got to leave some fossil fuels in the ground, we're in a transition period in which you get to be the transition team, the politicians get on TV and they piss and moan about national debt. They say, we're leaving you guys this debt. And that's terrible. That's wrong. Yeah? But there's a... I had a friend once say a wise statement to me once. It's only money. Well, shit, yeah, it's easy for you, it's only money. You know damn well there's things a lot more important than money. Yeah, money's an issue. But there's things more important than money. And is the earth we live on, is leaving the earth we live on in an untenable place? They think leaving a national debt, look at the earth we're leaving. That's what you guys ought to be mad about. Now, that 10 to 1 is not just any. Not all foods are not created equally. You can grow some food, like row crops, corn for example, you can actually still stay under calories in to calories out on some simple row crops. Corn, potatoes, they're under one. This is one big thing people are talking about when they talk about the sustainability of vegetarianism. But look, once you get in to chicken, turkey, eggs, beef, lamb, cattle, look how much energy you're putting in to get one calorie out. Shit, that's lucky the damn beefsteak doesn't blow up in your face, right? That much energy in it. All right, guys, I've cheered you up so much, we better take a break, get some tissues, and come back and I'll wrap this thing up for you. Awful quiet out there. Must be doing my job. You're Rowani, right?
Yeah.
How you doing?
Good.
I saw you made that basket in the tournament. Proud of you, dude. Yeah. Well, also, to the extent that the farmer's out there working his muscle, too, but that's a tiny fraction of it, yeah. But I'm not talking about sun.
So not any kind of, like, energy, whether it's, like, from a tractor or from a human, that's...
Yeah, exactly. And the point was, if it's just humans, you got to stay. If you put more energy in, you get out, you just starve, and you're not... that ends that. That's called a famine, right?
Okay, so... Okay, yeah.
See what I'm saying?
So one energy output produces 54 lamb or 57 lamb. Is that right?
No, you put, to get one bite of lamb, you have to put in 57 bites of gasoline.
All right, so, but that would mean like your energy input is higher than your
output.
Okay.
It's nothing sustainable about it.
Okay.
That's the point. Once you exceed 1-to-1, you're no longer sustainable. Yeah.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, you bet. Hey.
Can you sign a petition? We're asking UT to divest from the fossil fuel industry.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Right on.
That's your timing's impeccable, isn't it?
Yeah, right. Figured it would be. Yeah, we sent a letter to the CFO and the Board of Trustees that like make the decision on the investment, so I'm actually going to San Francisco this weekend to like meet up with a bunch of other schools and whatnot.
Good. I'm proud of you.
So,
good.
Yeah, man,
good
work.
Good work. Yes, absolutely. Not without hesitation. You know, while we're waiting for a few more people to trickle in, I'll say a complete aside to all this about sustainability and energy, and that is that both the men and women's basketball teams have come off a great run with the tournament play they were in, and I'm not going to embarrass anybody. We have a number of student athletes in this class, and now there's a lot of talk about, you know, how difficult it is to, and not just talk, it just is, to be a student athlete and also be a student, and all this thing about the money goes everywhere but the student athletes and all this kind of things. A lot of, yet we still see our athletes have the time and commitment to pass their classes and also to do things like play in the Sweet 16. So hey, let's give it, I'm not going to make them stand up or anything, but let's give a little hand to our student athletes. We got about a dozen of them in class here. So we thank you guys. All right. So we were talking about A student buttonholed me during class, during break, and said, let me see if I get this straight. And we talked about it a little bit more, just so to get everybody on the same page here. What we're talking about, the number on the left in the little ratio, is total energy, not sunshine, but total energy for like planting crops, tilling crops, harvesting crops, transporting crops. It's the energy that used to be done by people and donkeys and is now done by fossil fuels. And that's the energy we put in to get the same unit of energy out in terms of food energy for our bodies. We are literally eating fossil fuels. When you eat that was my point, when you eat that 250 calorie donut, you are burning up 2,500 calories of fossil fuels. And so in that gave you that donut. And the point is, that is not sustainable agriculture. All right, now that if I hadn't cheered you up enough, how about that? All right, what is that? That's obviously, yeah, a pterodactyl, and what's he seeing?
Asteroid destroyed.
Yeah. Yeah, that was that last great extinction 66 million years ago, when an asteroid struck what is now the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico and sent up a debris cloud that altered the world's climate for, I don't know, thousands of years, I guess. And anyway, that was when the dinosaurs disappeared from the fossil record. And so the point of me bringing this up is that if you look back through the fossil record on Earth, you see, and some of you have heard about this, there have been five major extinctions in which large proportions of the species on Earth disappeared. We know what caused this most recent one. We have geological evidence there's an iridium layer, and we found the place where it hit and everything. And some of the earlier extinctions, we see that the animals disappear in plants, but we don't know. We can kind of speculate on what caused, but we don't know exactly. But there were causes, and this has happened five times in Earth history. And these are not just you lose a few species. These are like losing some of the ones prior to this lost as many as 85% and 97% of the species on Earth. Okay? And so that's a lot. That's a lot. And why am I bringing this up here? Because there is a theory that I think has a lot of merit, that we have begun the sixth extinction, okay? The sixth mass extinction on Earth. And if you look at this last graph here, you'll see the rate of extinction, extinctions that occur per year there as skyrocketed since 1900. And this, of course, coincides with that human expansion perfectly, doesn't it? The numbers and the energy expenditure, the material wealth, all of that dovetails with look at those lights from space. Where do the animals live down there, huh? Where are the plants? Where do the insects? And so, and if anything, this extinction, exponential extinction graph is underestimated, because we don't even know what all we've killed. This is just what we think we've killed. And there seems to be no reason to believe this is going to stop. So in the end, and it could even accelerate. And back early on for that first test, I think there was even a question. I put it on the board out of the book, something about keystone species that other species depend on. And when you happen to step in its huge human footprint on a keystone species, you result in not one extinction, but many. Well, you know, so what? Right? Well, you know, the people say, well, you know, we have extinctions. Life goes on. Right? In fact, they're even talking about, Congress talking about modifying the Endangered Species Act. That it protects too much. Right? We don't need to give all this protection to these endangered species. Now, here's the thing. We've got this worldwide web of ecology. We all know this at some level, either very precisely if we're an ecology major, or in a more subtle way if we're not. But we all know that life depends on other life, that humans depend. We obviously could not live on a rock with only other humans. Right? So, at what point do we cut the web of life one too many times? At what point do we lose the last keystone species that causes the collapse, the free fall? There was an old, back when I was in your seats, there was an old environmentalist named Barry Commoner. And he had a great analogy for this so what question. Well, Earth seems to be, it's a pretty day out there. I don't see what the problem is. He says, look, let's say you get on a plane. Let's say the semester's over and you're going to get on a plane and fly someplace. And you're looking forward to getting out of town, getting out of Dodge. You get on the plane, you get your window seat, you look out over the wings. And there's all these rivets up and down the wings. You know, innumerable rivets holding this plane together. There, it's sitting there on the tarmac. And you're gazing idly out of there and, you know, waiting for other passengers to cram their shit in the overhead bin. And you happen to notice that one of those rivets pops out. Pop! Bink, 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 falls on the runway. You're alarmed. Shit, you're about to take off from this thing. Well, look at that Malaysia deal. I want my rivets. So you know, flag down the attendant and say, well, what about the, I saw this, see the holes? You count 100 out and 300 down. And try. And he tells you, that happens from time to time. But these planes, we have a built-in redundancy. So I'll tell the pilot, and I'm sure this will be taken note of at the next, you know, maintenance layover. But it'll be fine. You say, okay. You know, you're assured to a point. But then you're looking back out over there, and there's another rivet pops, and another pops. There's still thousands of them. But how many rivets fall out of that plane before you get the shit off that damn thing, huh? Get unbuckle your seatbelt, get out of my way. Bring that stairway back. Bring the jetway to me. I'm out of here. I'm not going to fly this thing. And yet, Barry Commoner said, we are on the airplane Earth. There is no place to land. We're over the South Indian Ocean, if you will. We're flying along. We look at those windows. All those species are rivets on our biosphere. And they're popping out all, we can see them. They're popping out faster and faster. We got sheet metal lightly on flapping. And they keep on popping out. You know, what are we going to do about this? At some point, the wing flies off. And you spiral down. We're not there yet, but we're getting there. And with that, I will mention there's a guy, you want me to make an announcement about your petition? The guy in the front row that's got a petition here that's very timely, I think, that I signed about the UT considering divesting and no longer holding investments in energy, fossil fuel energy companies, as a way of, you know, showing where UT's wealth should and shouldn't go. I would suggest you might want to consider supporting that. But in any case, we're done for today. Come back. We're going to talk about water pollution next time. Remember, we never get stuck in anything for very long.
That fisheries job I applied for.
Remind me, which one is that now?
The one in the Smokies.
Well, good for you, that's right.
Yep. You told me I should go ahead and do it. I got it.
Congratulations.
Thank
so
you.
You'll be working with Matt.
Yep.
That's wonderful. He's a great guy. Tell him hi. And you'll have a, you know exactly what you'll be doing?
Yeah, mostly electrofishing, and he said some snorkeling surveys and stuff later in the summer.
So, that's fun. Have you ever done that